Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A group of artists and filmmakers plans to recreate Germany's historic Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was built by communist East Germany. It divided Berlin from 1961 to 1989. Organizers say they will build a model of the Berlin Wall inside a small, closed-off area in the center of the German capital. The design will aim to create a feeling that visitors are inside a city within a city. The project is called DAO, Freiheit, or Freedom. Event organizer Berliner Festspiele recently announced the project. It is set to open on October 12th in Berlin's Unter den Linden area. The project still needs final approval from city officials. The closing is planned for November 9th. Event organizers say the wall and exhibits will be taken down that day. The date is meaningful. The real Berlin Wall began to come down on November 9th, 1989. Organizers have called the project a social and artistic experiment. Visitors will have to buy visas, the Associated Press reported. The visas will cost about $17.50. Once inside, visitors will be asked to hand over their phones. They will then be given another device to carry. This device will guide each person through different exhibits, including film presentations, music, and performance art. The aim of the experience is to begin a political and social debate about freedom and totalitarianism, surveillance, coexistence, and national identity, organizers told the Agence France-Presse news agency, or AFP. Germany's Minister of Culture, Monika Grütters, said she hopes the project will turn into a successful world event. But some critics expressed concern that recreating the Berlin Wall could be hurtful to some people who lived in communist East Germany. Out of respect for the victims who really experienced such situations, we should step away from this, Berlin politician Sabine Bangert told Germany's Tagesspiegel newspaper. The event will be used to launch the first showing of a film project by Russian filmmaker Ilya Zhirinovsky. The DAO film project has been in development for the past 10 years. DAO involved hundreds of actors living full-time from 2009 to 2011 in an environment modeled after a former nuclear research facility in the Soviet Union, the AFP reported. The actors who lived in the facility, which was built in Ukraine, were asked to dress, speak, and act as if they were actually living under a communist Soviet government. I'm Brian Lynn.
A new study suggests that ancient periods of cold and dry climate helped our species take the place of Neanderthals in Europe. Researchers found that such cold periods happened at the same time Neanderthals seemed to disappear in different parts of the continent. Their disappearance was followed by the appearance of our species, Homo sapiens. Neanderthals are a species of early humans that once lived in Europe and Asia. The species died out about 40,000 years ago. Homo sapiens arrived in Europe a few thousand years later. Scientists have long debated what happened. Some have blamed the change in climate. Others have proposed explanations, including the sudden spread of diseases and the idea that newcomers competed with Neanderthals for resources. Michael Staubwasser is a scientist with the University of Cologne in Germany. He and his research team reported their findings in late August in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The researchers examined existing climate, archaeological, and ecological data and added new measurements of ancient climate. Those measurements came from two caves in Romania. Their study centered around two cold and dry periods. One began about 44,000 years ago and lasted about 1,000 years. The other began about 40,800 years ago and lasted about 600 years. The timing of those events matches the periods in which objects made by Neanderthals disappear. Whether they moved or died out, we can't tell, Staubwasser told the Associated Press. During the two events, signs of Homo sapiens appear in sites within the Danube River Valley in Central and Eastern Europe and in France, the team noted. The changes in climate would have turned forests into grassland filled with small plants. Homo sapiens may have been better adapted to that new environment than the Neanderthals were. So they may have been able to move in after Neanderthals disappeared, the researchers wrote. Katerina Harvadi is a Neanderthal expert at the University of Tübingen in Germany. She was not involved in the study. She said it is helpful to have the new climate data from southeastern Europe. That is an area that many researchers think Homo sapiens used to spread through the continent. But Harvadi said it is unclear whether Neanderthals disappeared and Homo sapiens appeared at the times the researchers claim. She said that is because the studies they base their findings on depend on limited evidence and are sometimes disputed. Chris Stringer is with the Natural History Museum in London. He said he thought the paper made a good case for the effect changes in climate had on Neanderthals. Yet he believes other things also led to their disappearance. Rick Potts of the Smithsonian Institution called the study a refreshing new look at how one species took the other's place. As has been said before, our species didn't outsmart the Neanderthals, Potts wrote. We simply outsurvived them. I'm Pete Musto.
September 3rd is Labor Day in the United States. The national holiday began more than 100 years ago to honor low-paid factory workers. Labor Day also informally marks the end of summer. Many students return to school after Labor Day. The hot days of summer turn cooler. Many Americans celebrate the holiday with an outdoor family barbecue. But Labor Day started with a struggle. On May 1, 1889, workers demonstrated on the streets of Paris, France. International Labor Day was born. Most industrialized countries in the world, except the United States and Canada, celebrate Labor Day on the 1st of May. The first American Labor Day celebration was held on September 5, 1882, in New York City. About 10,000 workers marched through the streets to show the strength of labor organizations. For many years after that, American workers used the first Monday in September to demand better working conditions and pay. Music was a part of many of those marches. Labor songs traditionally tell stories of conflict and hopes for a better life. Here is Pete Seeger's We Shall Not Be Moved. Many classic American labor songs came from workers in the coal mines of the South. Mine owners bitterly opposed workers' unions. In Kentucky, company police searched for union leaders. They waited outside a worker's home for several days to block him from organizing. The coal miner's wife, Florence Reese, stayed inside with her children. She wrote this song, Which Side Are You On? Here is Natalie Merchant singing the song.
How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Another American labor song is called Bread and Roses. It is based on a poem by James Oppenheim, published in December of 1911. The poem speaks about the women's labor movement. At that time, conditions in factories, where many women worked, were horrible. A fire at a clothing factory in New York killed 146 people. Most of the victims were immigrant women. A month after Oppenheim's poem was published, textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike. Their protest won them higher pay and better working conditions. Oppenheim's poem gained more attention. Here is Judy Collins singing Bread and Roses.
That a sudden sun discloses, for the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Even though Labor Day demonstrations are not as common in the U.S. today, the song reminds us to celebrate the effort and love that many people give to their work. I'm Ashley Thompson.
I shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Heart, soul, as well as bodies, give us bread, but give us roses.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority. Giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. The elections were a big defeat for the Democrats in Congress.
A rising tide lifts all boats, so they say, and the Republicans are sailing right to victory in the House of Representatives, CNN estimating that the Republicans will take more than enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And here's what's interesting. It is cutting across all regions. It is cutting across all ages. It is cutting across literally all the candidates.
CNN reporter Frank Cessno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. President Clinton supported welfare reform to reduce spending on public assistance, but he blocked Republican efforts to cut what he believed was too much money from programs including health care for retirees and the poor. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers and displayed a captured American pilot, all of them soldiers who were taking part in an international effort to end the starvation of the Somali people themselves. These tragic events raise hard questions about our effort in Somalia. Why are we still there? What are we trying to accomplish? How did a humanitarian mission turn violent? And when will our people come home? These questions deserve straight answers. Let's start by remembering why our troops went into Somalia in the first place. We went because only the United States could help stop one of the great human tragedies of this time. A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying. Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen. Our troops created a secure environment so that food and medicine could get through. We saved close to 1 million lives.
and throughout most of Somalia, life began returning to normal. Nearly a million Somalis still depend completely on relief supplies, but at least the starvation is gone. And none of this would have happened without American leadership and America's troops. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law. Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. Others involved with Whitewater were in legal trouble by the time Bill Clinton, a former governor of Arkansas, became president. A former judge who owned a savings and loan bank accused Clinton of pressuring him to make illegal loans to help the company. Clinton denied that. And there were questions and accusations about Hillary Clinton from the years when she worked as a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In January of 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November of 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.